and welcome to the fifth in the Developing Perspective interview series. The Developing Perspective interview series is something that I do to break out of the 15-minute mold of just me talking and to hopefully talk with interesting developers about how and why they work. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Marco Arment, who I'll introduce more fully in a moment. And we're going to talk about just how he works and why he does the things that he does. So first, I want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show.
Anytime.
So probably the best place to start off is just to give a little bit of a background of sort of who you are and what you do.
Sure. Well, I'm Marco Arment. I currently work on a few projects. I have Instapaper, the magazine, Marco.org, the Neutral.fm podcast, and wasting all my day on Twitter at Marco Arment.
Excellent.
And I've currently forgotten about app.net.
Haven't we all?
Unfortunately. You know, I'm kind of upset about that because I got a really good username there. I just got Marco. And I joined Twitter too late for that, so I had to take Marco Arment on Twitter. And I kind of feel bad that app.net didn't take off and replace Twitter for me because I just have a way better username there.
Well, and I think it's the kind of thing for me that I'm glad that it's there. It's the fallback position. It reminds me a little bit about like Pinboard and Delicious, that I feel like at some point there'll be a day in the future where there'll be this mass exodus of nerds from Twitter for some reason that they're doing, and we'll all go over there, and I'll be glad it's there, and you'll have your great username.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope that happens. We'll see, I guess. So yeah. So anyway, that's what I do. I waste time on the internet, and when I'm not wasting time on the internet for about a half hour a day, I do some work.
So when you're doing that work, what kind of if you just kind of work through, what is that the physical environment and sort of the computers and things that you use, what's that kind of setup look like for you?
It's pretty straightforward. I work from home, and I have a home office, so it's just a room in my house that is called the office, and it contains my wife and I each have a Mac Pro and a desk and a monitor in this room, so it's just a room with two desks and computers. And really, I for the most part, for most of the day, I'm sitting here in headphones. Generally speaking, if I'm not wearing headphones, I'm not working. And because it helps to block out both ambient noise and, you know, noise. You know, we have a baby, so he's occasionally noisy, and just noise from the house and UPS deliveries and stuff like that. So it just, headphones help prevent distraction for me. And so basically watching me work looks like a guy typing while wearing headphones and not really moving until it's time for chicken salad.
Nice. And is that, that sounds basically like the same environment that you would have if you were working in a traditional like office too, right? That sounds like almost every time I've ever seen a software engineer working in a normal like cube farm or something like that, that's exactly the same thing.
Not only is it similar, it is my desk from Tumblr. I took it with me when I left. The actual physical desk.
Did they know about that?
Yeah, it was. I negotiated on my way out. It was because it's an electrically raising and lowering desk, and it's very nice. And I like being able to raise it to a standing position occasionally. It is very convenient. So I took that home with me, and even when I was working there, I would always try to have an exact clone of my work hardware set up at home. So at work, at first I had a laptop I'd bring between both places, just, you know, a 15-inch MacBook Pro. I put it on a stand, have an external keyboard, a mouse, and a 24-inch monitor. And then eventually I upgraded to a Mac Pro at home and went to two 24-inch monitors, and I convinced my boss at Tumblr to upgrade us there to the exact same thing. And so I always tried to keep parity of the hardware in both places because, you know, like, as a computer nerd, I'm sure you've always had a really nice monitor at home. Well, what if you go to work somewhere and you have, like, this tiny little, like, 17-inch monitor at work and you go home to your 30-inch? Like, that sucks, you know? Like,
yeah.
It sucks to have, like, worse equipment in one place or the other. And so, I try to make it as work-like as possible. Like, there are some people who, in fact, my boss at Tumblr, David, was like this, who are very comfortable working on a laptop, like on a couch. And I really can't do that for very long. Like, I'll do it if I'm on vacation somewhere and I have to get something done or I want to type something up. But I really prefer working at a desktop, at a desk, with a full-size keyboard, a mouse, and a giant monitor.
And it feels... Whenever I do, like, the only things that I can do in that kind of environment, if I'm not sitting in my fancy chair with my right keyboard, you know, with my Microsoft keyboard and my particular mouse and the whole thing, like, the only thing I can do there is it's like I can be sending email, maybe, you know, Twitter or something like that. But it doesn't feel like work unless I'm in that particular place, in my particular sort of setup, I find.
Right. And also because I have a giant monitor at my desk, every laptop screen feels cramped to me. So every laptop screen feels like, just like what you said, it's like I can get some stuff done here, but I'm not going to really get any, quote, real work done until I get back to my giant setup at home. And it really has nothing to do with synchronizing files or anything like that. I mean, those are all minor things when you have multiple computers versus single computers. Like, there are some minor issues like that, but for me, really the biggest thing is just I need a whole bunch of space and I need the comfortable ergonomic setup.
Yeah, and it just allows you to there's something, I don't even know if it's it's like almost like Pavlovian or whatever, right? Like, I don't know for you, but for me, it's like when I'm in that environment, that's where I can become productive, even if I'm not in the mood to be productive, by putting myself in that place in a way that's more difficult if I was just like pick up my MacBook Pro and just sit down and try and do something. It doesn't feel as it doesn't put me in that kind of mindset or in that frame of like, okay, I need to do some work. Let's get this done.
And again, back to the headphones, that really helps isolate myself from the outside world. Whereas when you're like on a couch with a laptop, that's harder to do. And my headphones usually are at my desk because they're tremendous. And so just like everything else on my desk, it's tremendous headphones, giant monitor, ridiculously giant keyboard because it's all big split ergonomic. Ergonomics are very important to me. I had a brief RSI scare during about my second year out of college when I was 2 years into working full time, where I started getting some pretty bad wrist pains, and it freaked me out so much, because RSI is such a big problem in our field, that I quickly switched my whole setup over to using a split keyboard and sitting properly with proper posture and knowing the proper height for desks and monitors and everything. And what a lot of people don't realize is, like, if you use a laptop on a desk all day, just by itself, that's really terrible for ergonomics. Like, it's one of the worst things you can do.
Yeah, your monitor's at the wrong height, your keyboard's at the wrong height,
your wrists are bending in, yeah. And just having the monitor at the wrong height, you're going to mess up your neck and shoulders probably. And I've talked to a lot of people who do work that way, and then like at the end of the day, they have like a sore neck or a headache, and they don't know why. And it's like, laptops are really. And I think this is going to be an increasing problem because laptops are so popular these days as people's primary or only computers. But they're really not designed ergonomically to work on for long periods. They're really designed for like occasional or portable use. And so if you do work on a laptop all day, at the bare minimum, you should really put it up on a stand and get an external keyboard and mouse. And ideally, you can even get a bigger monitor then, too. And that's a very good setup for a lot of people. I used that setup for years before I switched to a Mac Pro.
Yeah, and that's what I use right now. I mean, I have my Retina MacBook Pro connected to a 27-inch, cinema display. And it's strange because the Retina display is so nice, but I just find looking at a huge display feels more comfortable. There's just something being uncramped about it, even though the Retina actually has more pixels, I think. But it feels different because it's just spaced out and...
Yeah, and it definitely kind of pains me that the Retina MacBook Pro screen is so nice, but there is no big desktop version of it yet. That's one thing that I really hope is fixed soon in the computing world, because it's like there's this awesome screen that I want to use full time, but ergonomically I kind of can't, and practically it's kind of too small for me, and so just please fix this.
Especially because we know it's possible. It's just a question of timing and technology. It's not that it's some inconceivable technology that we're asking for. It's like the same thing, just stretch it out by an extra, 12 inches or something. So
right. It's like going all SSD for your storage. Like a lot of people can already do it. A lot of people can't. They need more space. And you can just, you know that in 5 years, you can probably go all SSD if you can't do it today. But, just from now to then, it's going to be this weird transition. Same thing with Retina.
Yeah. So moving in from the physical hardware, when you're actually working, what are the software, the tools, the things that you use outside of maybe the traditional ones like Xcode and Photoshop?
Well, I always, first of all, TextMate, of course, as my text editor. I'm actually using the TextMate 2.0. I don't know, is it an alpha? Is it a beta? I don't know. I'm using the TextMate 2.0 development branch, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's usable. It's surprisingly fun. In fact, I would say it's no more buggy than TextMate 1. Whatever. So I think if you're a TextMate user and you want to try out the newest stuff with TextMate, I think it's pretty. I would very safely recommend it at this point. I've been using TextMate 2.0 for about a year now. Ever since the alpha came out, I've been using it full time, and it's fine.
Yeah, I do as well.
Yeah, so that's good. And then, you know, kind of other software. I use desktop Twitter clients. I don't really like using Twitter much on my phone or anywhere else. The desktop is my primary environment. That's where I use it most. And I do have to use Twitter, have to with air quotes. I have to use Twitter a lot for work because I have to use Twitter to self-promote.
Sure.
And so what I'm, you know, I have an account for the magazine. I have an account for Instapaper, an account for Neutral, an account for my website separately for like the feed for people to follow. And so I use Twitter as a promotional channel very heavily. So my Twitter client's always open, and Solver's always open. Gotta have Solver. Solver, I don't know how it's said, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
We'll put a link in show notes or something. Do you have show notes?
Yes, I do.
Okay, we'll put a link in show notes. I cannot undersell this program to the audience. It is so good, especially for programmers. Anybody who works with numbers all day, even basic math. Solver, to give a quick description, is kind of the hybrid between a spreadsheet and a text editor. It's like a line editor almost, but you got to see it, you got to play with it. If you haven't tried it yet, delete calculator off your computer somehow. Either, you know, hide the icon, move it, somehow get rid of the calculator app. Never launch the calculator app again. Leave a Solver document open as a number scratch pad. And you'll be sold, trust me.
Yeah. The thing that I use Solver for, the thing that absolutely sold it for me was when I first realized that it did variables, mm-hmm. that I could say, you know, width equals 320, and then width becomes a token that I can use elsewhere in the document. That just blew me away as for usefulness for programming and for those types of things. Because A, it becomes basically a programming language at that point. It doesn't have, like, iteration, but it has the ability to kind of store things up and move them around in that way. And I was like, that's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it can really, not only will it replace calculator for most people, but it will also replace a lot of basic uses of spreadsheets, which is really, like, at this point, I use spreadsheets for very little casual everyday stuff because Solver is so good for that. So I cannot recommend this program highly enough. I've been beating this drum to death for, I don't know, 5 years. But eventually I will get everybody to use this program. It really is that good. In fact, I almost developed the iOS version of it. I was back about a year after Instapaper launched on the App Store, so around 2009 or so. I've been using Solver forever, and not a lot of people were using it at that point. And I went to the iOS, I went to the developers of it, and I said, hey, there really needs to be an iOS version of this. And I would love to make it, and I would love to license the engine from you and whatever else. And you know, here's how I think the interface would look. And they're like, you know, well, we have these concerns about the market. And, you know, and I'm like, look, whether you do it or I do it, I just want it to exist. And I just want to use it. And they're like, all right, we'll do it. Okay, that was it.
There you go. That's all the push they needed was to know that someone, it's like that there was a market for at least one person to use it on iOS.
Exactly.
So when you're sort of doing something new, when you're laying out a new, whether it be a new app or a new part of an app, what's your workflow in doing that? So if you start from an idea of I need a screen or I need an interface or I need something that does that, are you a pen and paper person? Do you get into something to mock it up in Photoshop or one of the other image editors? Do you just dive into code and just start building it? What's your kind of workflow for you have a new idea and you want to kind of get it going?
I would love to be a pen and paper person, but I'm not. I would love to be a Photoshop person, but I'm not. I have Photoshop. I use Photoshop, but not for any kind of mockups. I really am a just get in there and code it person. I tend to have some idea of how I want something to look, but for the most part, I just dive in there and I code it from the bottom up. So, you know, the data model, the views, kind of from the bottom up. And And then I put the pieces together afterwards, which actually does help in a lot of ways, keeping the MVC roles separate, because I'm kind of forced to by the way I make things. But really, for the most part, I really just kind of build it. I jump right in, and I know a lot of people say you aren't supposed to do that, and they're probably right. I just don't have the artistic skills or the self-control to go to paper or Photoshop first and make prototypes and throw three of them away. I don't do that. I just go right into the feature and just make it. And if it sucks, I don't ship it. But for the most part, if I'm gonna make something, and most of what I make, I do ship. If I'm gonna make something, I just jump right in and do it.
And I think a lot of that speaks to it's wherever you're gonna be. Wherever you're going to be fastest in, or whenever you're going to be able to go most quickly from your idea to some realization of it, to see if it's a good idea. And for, I'm the same as you. I just code things. I remember I was writing for Check the Weather, a weather app I recently launched. I drew one picture on a piece of paper, and I still have it. Just a little piece. It's like this tiny little sketch, essentially like on a napkin, but it was just in a notebook in my office, and that's it. And then everything else was just in code. It was like, I just needed that concept of like, yep, it's going to have a panel to the side, the bottom, and the other side. Okay, that's it.
And yeah, and you know, you have to kind of try it. And for a lot of people, myself, and it sounds like you included, you kind of have to try something, a working prototype, before you really know whether it's good or not.
Yeah, especially for something as tactile as iOS. It's there's something different of, will it even work in your hand is... You hear about people, you know, so if you're a lot of designers have those tools that mirror the interface on their device to get some sense of it. But there's that sense of you want it to see if your idea will actually work. And when you're actually touching it and playing with it and seeing, you know, putting it into reality.
Exactly.
And then it's like, so then on the other end of that, what's your workflow once you've built something in terms of testing and debugging on the back end of creating an app? Obviously you've launched enough apps and are on enough platform, sort of enough, been doing this for a long enough time that you, in terms of dealing with compatibility, dealing with all the kinds of challenges that you have in terms of making sure that what you think is going to work will actually work for everybody.
Part of how I do that is just by keeping the feature set relatively light. You know, I try to reduce the number of possible configurations and conditions that my apps can be in, just so that I don't have to test so many different things. And so, for example, I've been much more aggressive than you recommend with the iOS version updating and requiring minimum iOS versions. I was requiring iOS 5 for Instapaper, I think, a year ago, and I required iOS 6 from the magazine's launch in October. Which wasn't that long after iOS 6 came out, but yeah. I think it was a few weeks after it came out. Actually, it really was not very long at all. And for the most part, the reasons why I do that are to reduce testing and to reduce bug potential. Really, so that's part of my approach. And the other part is I just use these apps a lot. So, you know, you have a little bit of a different problem because you do a lot more apps than I do, and you at least used to do a lot of consulting. For me, I only make two apps, and I use them both all the time. And so pretty much almost any problem that I'm going to run into with the apps, I'll run into myself during development. It's very, very rare that a bug in production comes out that I didn't know about in development or that never happened to me in development. I might not have known how to fix it yet, or I might have thought I fixed it, or I might have thought the conditions that lead to it are so rare that it would never be a problem. But usually I have at least seen every bug in development, and usually I try to fix most of them.
Do you find that works well in terms of both the split between iPhone and iPad, in terms of using them both enough to get good coverage that way? Because the thing that I struggle with is I use my iPhone all the time. It's within arm's reach essentially 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And yet, my iPad I use very sparingly, and so I always struggle with then on my apps. All the iPhone's versions tend to be 10 times better than the iPad versions, just because that's where I'm used to and that's where I'm working.
Yeah, I mean, I have a little bit of that problem. I don't think it's as bad as what you're saying because, well, with the magazine, if I'm going to ship a really terrible bug on the magazine that only happens on one platform, it'll be the iPhone because I hardly ever use the magazine on the iPhone. That's almost always iPad. And Instapaper, I kind of use half and half. So it's not, I don't think it's really a problem for me that way, because I use it on both platforms pretty reliably. And if I ever made any more apps, that would be a problem.
Yeah, it's just the thing that actually, that honestly, that as I think about it even more, that I struggle with recently has been making iPhone apps look good on the old stubby screens.
Oh yeah,
because
no one's buying those anymore.
It's like I never see it. I obviously I have testing devices and things, but the phone that I use all the time that I'm doing most of my testing is, you know, an iPhone 5, and so it's like, it's always a little awkward when I run out, you know, you turn it around, run it on the old screen, and it's like, oh, that doesn't work.
Right, like the keyboard slides up and something's covered, or, you know, some minor layout problem like that where, yeah, that is a good point, actually, now that we have a different size screen that we're not really using reliably anymore ourselves. I probably have bugs I don't know about. It helps me a little bit that I designed Instapaper for that old phone. You know, it was more like the iPhone 5. I just had to stretch everything out and, you know, stretch some flexible borders, and that was about it.
Yeah, and also,
if you started out on the iPhone 5 with a new app, I could see where that could be a problem.
Yeah, and I mean, it depends a lot on the content of your app too. If it's something that's vertically scrolling, it's usually a lot better. The place that I struggle with, right. So you'll have like a profile screen, or you'll have some kind of informational screen, and you want that layout to look perfect. And it's very hard to make it work perfectly on both platforms. Because, like, which one are you going to make look best?
Exactly. And I found, too, over time that at first I was designing for the iPhone and just kind of blowing it up for the iPad. And then over time I've switched to the opposite, where now I'm mostly designing for the iPad and then trying to figure out how to shove it into the iPhone after I know what it wants to do and what it's going to look on the iPad first. And I don't. That probably isn't great, honestly. But that's, you know, it depends on the kind of app you're doing. Like for a reading app, like both of mine, I think the iPad experience really matters more.
Sure, and it's even where, from a business side of it, it's where your most of your customers going to be. Where's most of your usage going to be coming from? It matters far more than anything else, because your ultimate goal is to make the most customers as happy as possible. And so wherever they're going to be using it is where they want, you know, the most optimal and best experience.
Exactly.
So, all right. And then sort of moving out of the workflow side of things, it's one of the things I always try and sort of get into is to kind of the why you work, or the sort of where you see things on that side of things. And it's what I was curious is where do you see, as someone who's been, you, I think if I'm remembering right, Instapaper launched on the first day the iOS App Store launched. Am I remembering that right?
It was like the third day. It was annoying. I got there in time for the deadline, but they had too many apps than they expected. So like I got bumped.
But you've essentially been in there from the beginning. And it's obviously the App Store today is a totally different beast than it was back then. And it's, I'd be curious from your sort of your take on where do you see the biggest opportunities in the App Store these days? Specifically, sort of far focused on more of the smaller independent style of developer shop.
Sure. I think it's important. You know, a lot, I hear all the time from people, from bloggers, from developers, I hear all the time this idea that all the low-hanging fruit is gone. And that the App Store is now so big that little people can't get noticed anymore. And I don't think that's the case. I really don't. I think that's crap. And I think people say that either to discourage themselves from taking an effort, or to excuse poor sales of something that just wouldn't have sold well regardless of when it was released. I really don't think that's true at all. I think there is still tons of potential in the App Store. And one of the easiest examples of that to point out is how you, I think you and Brent talked about this last week, or whenever you're releasing this, that time interval, talked about Clear, the to-do list that's all gestury and orange and gradients. And Clear came out with a very small team, and it got noticed, and it exploded, and because it was good. It was noteworthy. I actually still use Clear as my shopping list app. It's a good app. And there are a million to-do apps in the App Store, all with checkmark icons. There's a million of them. And yet, there is still room for new ones that do something interesting or that are different from the other ones in some way that people want. So I think there's infinite potential. I don't know if that's mathematically true, but there's a lot of potential out there still left to be tapped for not only creating new kinds of apps, but for creating just new takes on common apps. You know, like I've talked a lot how if I ever get free time, which is unlikely, honestly, but if I ever get some free time, I'd love to do my own podcast client. And there's a million podcast clients already out there, some of which I like a lot. And so that and there's a few that are really successful in the App Store. In fact, I think Instacast and Downcast sell about as well as Instapaper most of the time, if not better. You know, they're very successful, and you know, I would love to do my own podcast client someday because I have some ideas that I'm not going to tell everybody, but I have some ideas on things I would do differently than what everyone else is doing. And I think you can point to almost any app category in the App Store as a user of these platforms. You can say, you know, if I was making this kind of app, I would do things differently in this way, or I would add this one feature that none of these apps really have. Or even a simpler thing, I would totally change the visual design to a different type of mood or theme or style. Those are all. I mean, look at Clear. Clear is, you know, it's a very simple type of app in theory, the to-do list, and they did a really radical visual design, really radical functional design with the gestures and everything, and that was compelling for people, even though it lacked most of the features of the advanced to-do apps, and in many ways. That was a feature.
And it seems like it's a lot of that is finding the right niche there. It's you don't have to address the entire market. You only need probably a few hundred people a day to like it. And so that helps a lot with that. If a server where it's like even if there's a million podcast clients or a million to-do clients, you only need a few hundred people a day to say, "Hey, I like that," for it to be, you know, a sustainable, reasonable business.
Right, because if a few hundred people a day give you a few dollars each, that's a job.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a pretty good job usually. Yeah. You know, that's all you need to do. And the iOS market is so big. There are so many people using iOS devices, and it is still fairly routine for people to spend money on apps. And I'm not sure that's always going to be the case. I think it probably will be for a while more, and then it'll switch more to in-app purchase stuff and stuff like that. But you know, we're seeing the beginnings of that now, but I still think you can, either way, whether it's in-app purchase or upfront, I think it's very clear to everyone in this business that people are spending real money on iOS to solve problems or just for fun, for entertainment. So, you know, apps are like the new going out to see a movie. Like, if you have some free time with your phone or your iPad, and you want to try out some new stuff, you'll go to the App Store and you'll go spend $5 or $6 on a few new apps. That's a form of entertainment now for so many people. I do it. Do you do it?
Sure, yeah.
Lots of people do this.
Yeah,
And so even with that, you don't even need to have like a groundbreaking bombshell of an app that's going to get on all the, you know, all the sites and CNN reporting on it and everything. You just have to have something interesting that people haven't seen before or that does something a little bit differently that kind of looks like, oh, hey, maybe I'll try that. I mean, I bought tons of apps that I don't have on my phone anymore. I don't regret having bought them. I bought them to try them. And that's the fact. That's iOS business. That's it right there. Like, people do that all the time. So you don't have to think in these giant terms like, oh, what am I going to do entering this market with a big competitor? Or, you know, what happens if someone else comes in here and kills my app? You know, kill in quotes. And I don't think people have to really think that way. I think it's very apparent that there's room on iOS for lots of different interpretations of the same concept, and there's tons of potential concepts, some of which have been discovered already and beaten to death, but even those have some life left in them, and some of them people haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah, and it's I think it makes me think so much of the so often people get too wrapped up in how they define being successful on the App Store. That you can get so wrapped up into trying to be the next whatever it is. It's the next – I want to be the next Camera Plus. I want to be the next Clear or whatever it is. That it's like you, the sort of the more runaway hits. Right. And the reality is you can build a very, very good business not being anywhere near there just by doing the basics right over and over again and building a, you know, a small but consistent user base.
Exactly. And a lot of people just don't see that option. Or, you know, they only see what becomes big and famous because that's what gets to them, you know, press-wise or attention-wise, and they don't see all these jobs in the middle. You know, it's like when you're in high school and your parents start asking you what kind of job you want to do for the rest of your life, and at that point you're aware of like maybe 30 jobs that exist.
Yeah.
And so you got to pick between these 30 jobs that you know of that exist. Well, do I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, or a teacher? Like there's not that many that you know of. And then you get into the real world and you realize like, wow, there is somebody who has to climb up on that bridge and paint it. Like that's a job I didn't know existed until high school or if I watched the Discovery Channel. Or like you know, there's where you get into the workforce and you see people who are like, I don't really think they do anything all day. It sounds like their job is really easy, but someone's paying them a full-time salary to like use Twitter.
Yeah.
Like there's all these jobs that you don't see until you're kind of in it. And that's how iOS apps are. Like, you know, from the outside, you see the big hits. You see the top grossing list, which, as you said last time, I agree, is mostly useless. You know, you see the high-profile stuff, but there's this entire massive world of the middle class of iOS apps, and it's really a massive middle class. There is so much potential there, and yeah, I'm not gonna be the next Angry Birds by any means with any of the apps I make in all likelihood, and neither will anybody who's hearing this in all likelihood. But that doesn't mean that you can't make a good living on the App Store just making a handful of apps that, or even one app that people like, and it doesn't have to be half the world who likes it. It can just be a few hundred thousand people who like it. That's a good living.
Yeah, I mean, it's that difference of I think it's so easy to be distracted by the sort of the concept of being. It's like App Store millionaires, right? As a concept,
right.
It's like whereas there's far more, and it's probably a better thing to aim for to be an App Store 100,000-aire. Or whatever it is, like
I was going to say it if you weren't.
It's like you want to do to have that goal. I remember when I first started out, and I was trying to convince my wife or talking to her about, I want to make apps. At the time, I was doing Rails work for a larger company, and I was like, make something. I want to do something on my own. And originally, sort of the deal in some ways was like I could focus on it fully. I think it was once I made I had to consistently make $200 a day in the App Store. Which isn't easy by any means. You know, it takes a lot of work to get to there. But that was my goal, which works out to be, I think, about $70,000 a year or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
It's like that was – because like, okay, that's a salary. That's what I need to – that's and that goal, when you kind of squish it down in that way, makes it so much more sort of attainable and tangible for what you're trying to do. It's not – I'm trying to meet millions of users or have a system or you know an infrastructure that can scale to that. It's like it's just a few hundred people a day, and that's it.
Right. And there's a lot of – I know this is going a little off track, but I think it's fun anyway. There's a lot of stress. Like I was – before I took Instapaper full-time, I was really scared to do it. And I probably should have done it like a year earlier than I actually did, but I was too scared to leave my full-time job with health insurance. And so, when I took it full time, I had to do like crazy scary things, like address the health insurance problem and do my own taxes and stuff like that. And you know, I was doing some of that beforehand, but not most of it. And then I realized, you know, once I was going, like, okay, well, health insurance, that's just a number.
Yep.
You know, I got to pay. Well, here I pay a ridiculous amount because it's New York, so I pay like you know $2,000 a month. For health insurance from my family. And it's like, well, that's a lot of money. That's really scary, but that's just a number. So that's okay. If I want to do this full time, I have to make whatever I wanted to make before plus $2,000 a month. And
yep.
Okay, then that's, you know, X dollars a day, whatever that is. And okay, so that you figure it out. It's just a number. And just like, you know, starting a business was this intimidating thing for me. Well, it's just paperwork that you got to file. That's it. You file some paperwork and you are officially a business. You know,
like it's almost scary how easy it is to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually, you know, I feel bad for people who live in countries where it's a lot harder to do, because I know in the U.S. it's almost notoriously easy. But yeah, the fact is in the U.S. starting a business is really, really simple. Making money is not so simple, but having a business entity is quite easy. And so, like, there was all this. I was so scared to do it, and you know, before I did it full time, I was so scared because I had always just heard, or there was this mythos around, you know, going on your own, you got to do everything yourself, and oh, what do you do about benefits, and all these big questions. By the way, on this topic, if the U.S. really cared about small businesses, we would have nationalized health insurance for this exact reason. But that's a different topic. I'm going to get you so much angry email,
that's
David.
It's
going to be great. So, you know, I think starting a business and being independent on the App Store and succeeding, and of course, you know, success is a variable there. It's like, yeah. You know, people wonder, oh, how do you succeed on the App Store? Well, what do you mean by success? You know, I think most people mean money. And you have to be more specific. You have to, okay, well, you know, how much money do you need to make to consider it a success? And again, it's not some big scary thing. You just add up all these numbers. You say, all right, well, if I have this much coming in, then I have to spend this much on health insurance, this much on accounting, this much on taxes, and blah, blah, blah. You go down the list, and then you have at the end a number, and that's roughly, you know, what you get to keep. And then you can say, all right, well, then in order to get there, I have to make this, and that's it. And if you make it, you're succeeding. And you have about as much job security as you have at any real job anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the biggest part, I remember when I was going out on my own, I think, for about 7 years now. And it's the biggest part of that was the real understanding that if at the end of whatever it was, a few weeks, a few months, a few years, if those numbers all suddenly crossed over and I was unable to keep doing it, it's not like I have a gap in my resume that I've created. If anything, I'm more desirable to most smart companies as somebody who's gone through that experience and tried to be entrepreneurial, who understands all these other different parts of what being a successful business looks like, than I would have if I just stayed at my old job, writing code, being like one of, you know, a dozen programmers sitting there working on a project. And I think understanding that it's like the worst case, the absolute probably the worst case scenario for if this happens is I'll end up with no job and I'll have to go find one, which, okay. But I'll be coming at that from a position of a lot of really interesting, recent, good experiences.
Exactly. And you know, like, you'll have your name on all those things. Like, if you spend 7 years working at a big company, a lot of times, depending on what you're doing, you can't really put your name on anything big that an outside employer would have heard of or can easily see or view or browse. You know, that's one of the reasons why people in our field are so often encouraged to contribute to open source projects. So because then potential employers can at least look and see, okay, here's what you've done. Here's an example of your code. Here's a product that you helped contribute to or design entirely yourself. Those are all very helpful to look at. When you work at a big company, a lot of times you aren't allowed to disclose what you worked on, or you can't show the code that you worked on or things like that. Or what you worked on is just some boring internal thing that no one even cares to hear about. Whereas, yeah, if you have to go get a job, you can show them this giant pile of apps that you've made entirely yourself and say, hey, here's everything I did in the last 7 years.
Yeah. And as soon as I got my head around that, I was like, oh, that's not so scary. I don't have any, like, I have the illusion of job security working a corporate job, in the sense of I feel like it's stable just because every month they've, you know, direct deposited into my bank account. But there's nothing to say that they can't just, you know, the next day I show up, they're like, hey, sorry, the contract was canceled, you're out.
Yeah, I think a lot of people overestimate their job security until there's something like that happens. A lot of people think that any full-time job is inherently secure, and it really isn't. And I would say that, you know, the job security of most full-time jobs, especially in our business, is roughly the same as your self-employment job security. unless you're like really terrible at it or something. But for the most part, I think it's pretty much the same where, you know, yeah, if you're self-employed, maybe you couldn't run at the same job for 8 years, you know, working for yourself. If you're employed at a big company, maybe you can go there for 8 years before you get laid off or fired or driven to quit because it's so miserable. So it's, you know, you have about the same job security, I think, in both conditions.
Yeah, and it's just, I don't know. I mean, I think we're both in the same boat of enjoying it, but I think the upsides of having control over what you do and the final say on the quality of it, on the nature of what you're doing, and the sort of the motivations behind it is ultimately even a bigger incentive than it's not like the two are even neutral in terms of, you know, one being about the same as the other. At least from my perspective, I don't know why it's like I at this point I'm unemployable. I think I don't think I could go and work at a regular job and be happy.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't. I'm totally with you on that. I mean. And I would imagine you're probably a control freak because I know I sure am. Is that fair?
It's just certainly in the area of software. Right. Maybe not as much in other parts of my life, but definitely
in terms of what you do.
Yeah. I
never really like being told what to work on. And I imagine this is very common, especially in software developers, because like usually most software developers, I would imagine. I guess I don't have any data to back this up, but I would imagine most software developers started at a young age programming as a hobby. And when you have started that way, it's probably – I know like some of the best programmers I've worked with were very difficult to employ because yes. They always wanted to go off and like on some tangent doing their own thing with something that was technically interesting. And it was really hard to get them to like meet a deadline or like ship or work on some really boring feature that or, you know, some back end stupid administrative thing or fix some really obnoxious bug because they instead wanted to be working on the cool new thing, the interesting thing. And that's, I think, so prevalent in our industry. It kind of helps it helps us have so many independent workers because there's so many people who like, I want to work on what I want to work on, damn it. And you can't tell me what my homework is.
Yeah, and there's an opinionation about – or like being a very opinionated person, I find, seems to be also another attribute of a lot of the kind of software developers who end up going into independent work. It's like there's so many different ways to solve a problem in software that – but in my mind, there's almost always only one that's correct and the rest are terrible ideas. And obviously, intellectually, I know that's not right, and that probably somewhere in the middle there might be something there. But I'm just an opinionated person. I'm like, nope, that's the way I do it because that's better.
Right, and because you work for yourself, you can do it exactly that way. You know, like a long time ago, Merlin Mann on Back to Work, his podcast, a long time ago, there was like three episodes in a row about the concept of agency and being in control of what you're working on and you know being in control of your destiny professionally, basically. And how, you know, when you're just somebody's employee, you have given up some of that control in exchange for less risk-taking, less liability, a more stable paycheck, et cetera, the benefits of working for somebody else. But if you really want that control, that's always going to be a friction point in that relationship where – you know, if you are the kind of person like you and I, if you're the kind of person who really wants to work on what they want to work on and doesn't want to do the boring homework, then every single time your boss tells you to do something, it's going to kind of hit that nerve. And you're probably not going to do as good a work there as you could because you're going to be working on stuff you don't want to be working on. And for a lot of people, I know, certainly myself included, that means less productivity. You know, when your heart's not in it, that means you don't do as good a work. And or at least as much work. And so for me, I always kind of found like a Tumblr. I was at Tumblr for the longest part of the longest uninterrupted part of my career. And I was lucky there that I could pretty much invent whatever I was working on. There were some problems that I'd have to solve just out of necessity. But a lot of times I basically had the freedom there to say, you know what? I want to spend the next 2 weeks designing a new cache layer or, you know, doing something like that, something that I found interesting. And, you know, certainly not all the time, but it was a lot of the time. That's one of the reasons why I was so happy there for so long. But now it's even better because now I decide everything I do and don't do for the most part. And of course, you know, there's always, even when you run your own business, there's always things that you have to do just as part of reality or, you know, the law, like accounting paperwork. There's always stuff you have to do. There's some overhead, but there's a heck of a lot less stuff that you have to do that you don't want to do for the most part if you've set it up that way.
It does make me – this is something that I struggle with, and I'm curious what you, how you tackle this. That the most difficult part I find of being independent is dealing with the concept of software maintenance, or you're doing work that isn't that interesting new problem, that isn't that interesting new app, that isn't that interesting new concept, that it's going back and doing compatibility updates for an older app or making it doing – I mean, even you imagine an app like Instapaper at this point. Like, there's just a certain amount of the reality of the a lot of the interesting problems have already been solved, but you're still working on maintaining it and keeping it going. How do you balance those two? The, sort of the urge to be always be on working on the interesting thing and the necessity to kind of be, you know, you're the only person who can work on it, so you just kind of have to.
It's occasionally hard. I think in the case of Instapaper, what helps a lot is that the app is pretty mature at this point. I don't really have to do much to it to just keep it going. And I, you know, I've set up the servers in such a way to be pretty low maintenance because that's just that's how I've always done things out of necessity. And so I've really kind of set up the whole product to be low maintenance, you know, relatively low costs of running it, you know, low overheads. Really, you know, Instapaper's biggest cost every month is just the servers that it runs on. And, you know, it's, if I have the urge to add a new feature to it, I can do it. But at the same time, like, I decided this past summer and fall to start up the magazine. And one of the reasons I was able to do that was because Instapaper was at this point where I could kind of de-emphasize it for a while. And I don't intend for that to be permanent, and I intend to re-emphasize it soon because the magazine is now reaching a stable point. But I had that freedom because the app is pretty low maintenance. And so when I jump back into it and start, you know, really working on this big upgraded version full time, which I still haven't done, but once I start doing that, I think it's I kind of have, first of all, I have the freedom now that I have an additional source of income, which then it kind of frees me up with Instapaper to be a little more experimental. Because when Instapaper was my only income, it was very, very hard for me to take any risks with it. Because, like, you know, if I wanted to, like, remove a feature that was really old and crufty and causing lots of problems and making it hard to move forward. Like a long time ago, I did that with the RSS folder feature, which was a terrible idea. When I wanted to remove a feature, that was a really, really hard thing to do because I knew it would anger people. When I wanted to raise the iOS minimum bar, that was a really hard thing to do because I was afraid, you know, this is my only income. What if I anger everybody? You know, everyone's going to go jump to Clipped or whatever if I anger them, you know, whatever my new competitor this month is. And that was always a big stress point. Now, I have the magazine income, and I have my blog income, and I have occasional podcast income, and so now I have something else to fall back on, so I can say, you know what, with Instapaper, I'm going to do what I want to do here, and I know a lot of people are going to follow me on it, I know a lot of people are going to love what I'm doing, and I'm going to get some new customers, and if I anger a handful of existing customers, that's just the cost of the progression of time here.
Yeah, and I've had a very similar experience in that. The biggest peace of mind I've been able to grow in my business is by diversification into having all my eggs in many baskets. And so you can be more – even just from a peace of mind perspective, it's like in aggregate, you'll probably end up the same. Even if one thing's going down, there's a good chance something else will be going up.
Exactly. And again, like – if I really screw up big time and I somehow kill Instapaper by trying to update it, then I'll make a podcast client. You know, like there's always more to do. I mean, every time I need an app for something, this happens a lot. Like if I go on a trip somewhere, or if there's some kind of like single specialized purpose single use that I have for an app and I go to the store and try to download something, I'm always appalled at how bad most of the options are. And so like almost every month I run into some situation like this where I need a new app for something and I think, man, if I had the time, I would make the crap out of an app that does this. Yeah. and just really do this right, you know? And I don't have time because I'm working on the other apps. So if I really screw up royally and somehow torpedo one of my main apps, then I'll have some free time. You know, yeah. Then it's not that big of a problem.
Just move on and...
Yeah, make something else.
And I think the last area I wanted to talk about, I thought was interesting, is if you kind of think about... You've been doing this for long enough that you've probably made a few mistakes. And I'm curious if you could talk about... Maybe it's always a funny question to say what's the biggest mistake you've made, but the sort of business or technically, but an interesting mistake that resulted in a lesson that was worth learning, that you, something that you as you go forward, you're thinking about, I definitely don't want to do that again.
I definitely think it's hard to say because I haven't fixed this mistake yet, so it's hard to say whether it was a mistake. I think in retrospect, what I'm going to regret the most with Instapaper especially, is not having hired help earlier. Because I've been doing Instapaper mostly myself. I have somebody else, the awesome Richard Dunlop Walters, who does the feature, formerly Give Me Something to Read, who picks the stories for that and edits that whole thing. In fact, he even does like the site layout for that now. He took the whole thing over. He's awesome. And he does all that and all the support emails. But beyond that, and beyond occasional design contracting for like little, you know, mostly little things, I really have done all of Instapaper myself. And that's partially because I'm a control freak and partially because I am scared to delegate, but also partially because I'm scared of the cost of bringing on anybody else full time. You've talked a lot about having had full time employees in the past or even having worked with just contractors on a long term basis. I've never done that really. And so that does scare me. But with the magazine, putting together a magazine turns out to be so much work. The app is easy. The app I've been working on, but it's, you know, the app is going to be done, and, you know, for the most part, quote, done, you know, relatively soon, as soon as I fix the main bugs left. But the editorial side of it is just so much work that I had to hire Glenn Fleischman, the editor, almost full-time already. And once I hired him, I realized, and part of this is just because Glenn's ridiculously awesome, but I realized just how awesome it is to have help. When I hired Richard to do the feature and the Instapaper support, those were things I was barely doing anyway. So those support I was mostly ignoring, which I know is terrible, but that's the reality. I was mostly ignoring support emails, and the feature was relatively quick to do. When he took over, it wasn't that big of a problem. Just, you know, I saved a little bit of time every day from not doing the feature, and all the support emails started getting answered. But I wasn't doing that before, so it wasn't that big of a savings. When I hired Glenn for the magazine, though, doing all the editorial work, I was doing the editorial work for the first couple of issues, and it was so much more work than I thought it would be. Once I hired him, it was a massive burden lifted off of my shoulders. And I realized then the value of help, the value of having somebody who's doing work for you that, you know, and he took things in a direction that, you know, he did things a little bit differently than I would have done them. Turns out I like the way he does things.
Yeah.
and, you know, like, so I would like to hire help for Instapaper, I think. And maybe this is how I get to do my podcast client. I don't know yet. I haven't decided all this yet. But, you know, I want help for Instapaper because I would like to free up more of my time. And so I think in retrospect, I am going to have that regret of seeing, you know what, I probably should have hired somebody like 3 years ago. But we'll see.
Yeah. The interesting part I found is that the biggest lesson I found is to try and identify the things that you do on a repeated basis that someone else could do as well or better than you could. And those are the things that you want to try and – like I have somebody who does the help desk for me. She also does my books, my accounting, my taxes. She's an operations wizard. Like that's what she does. And
that sounds awesome.
She does it in a way that's – It blows my mind. It's in a totally different world, and it's at the time when it's sort of sorting it out. It's like, oh, does this make sense? Is that good? But it's like the reality is that's what she. It's like she's an expert in that, in the same way that I'm, I guess, at this point, an expert in iOS development or something like that. And so finding those things, it's like I derive no joy from that work. I don't like doing my books. I don't like doing that kind of. Those kinds of things. I enjoy doing help desk to some degree, especially when I, you know, a first launch or something. Maybe it's good to be in there and making sure I really have a good sense of things. But at the end, after a little while, it becomes very rote, and it becomes just a question of, you know, giving people some time and some reaction. But it's the same questions every single time.
Right. And so, like, how many password resets do you want to answer per day?
Yeah, or just the same. It's like one of my apps is an audiobook app, and the number of times I get an email asking me why Harry Potter is not in my app, my book catalog. It's not even joke. There was the first like autoresponder I ever wrote was, I'm sorry, you know, I've been unable to secure the rights to include Harry Potter for free in my audiobook app that you also downloaded for free. I'm sorry, that's a disappointment, but that's where we find ourselves.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing. So I definitely think, you know, the lack of – and again, like, I was doing so much more of my own accounting and bookkeeping, too, for a while. And over the last 2 years, I've finally hired an accountant, and I finally just started using QuickBooks Online, which is horrible, but it saves me time. And what do you – out of curiosity, what do you use for accounting? I know this is a bit of a derail, but like,
no, that's fine.
For bookkeeping, like, do you use a particular software package, or does your employee handle all of that and not even you don't even know?
So it's QuickBooks. That's what she uses.
Online or local?
Local on the Mac. I never see it except for probably maybe 3 or 4 times a year when we do kind of like a quarterly review or something, or sometimes she'll just send me roll-up reports and things, but. It's to a point now that, yeah, I mean, she could use whatever she wants. I know she uses QuickBooks because that's what she wanted and what she wanted to use, which is mostly because that's what our tax preparer prefers to get the import from.
Yeah, that's always the case.
But the key there was just to – it's whatever she – it's like she – that's her specialty. That's what she does. You know, she's an operations and finance person, and so like it's kind of like if she comes up and says like I need this tool, I need this thing, it's like, absolutely, whatever. That's money well spent for me to make you as productive as possible, because obviously that's less time I need to be paying for. And then on the flip side, it's like the better you are at your job, the better my business is running. So
see, like in that way, then what I just asked was actually a terrible question. The right question is, why am I still worrying about this?
Yeah, that's the better question.
That's a much better question. It's like, why should I need to care what accounting software I'm using? Because why am I doing my own accounting at all? Because I've already outsourced like 80% of it to my accountant. Like, why don't I just outsource the rest to somebody or them also? I guess that's a very good question.
And it's something you can apply to a lot of different sides. I mean, I had someone recently ask me a question about if the icon for Check the Weather was created in Photoshop or Illustrator.
Do you?
I was like, I have no idea. I contacted a designer, you know, that went to the Icon Factory. They did a great job. I told them a concept. They came back with pixels that looked pretty. I have no idea how, like, they could have individually drawn those in MS Paint. I have no idea. That's like, that doesn't matter to me because that's not where I'm seeking to put my effort or put my time or put my energy. It's like, I want to focus on the things that I'm good at, and everything else, I'll try and find someone who can do it better than I can.
I definitely have a lot to learn from your method. Also, and one other thing too, I realize it was kind of a dodge for me to say my biggest mistake was a mistake I'm not sure that I actually have made yet. So a more concrete example, because I'm far from perfect, I've made tons of mistakes. A more concrete example, recently when I launched the magazine 1.0, the data storage engine. And I know that Brent just talked about this, so I'll try to be brief. The data storage engine in the magazine 1.0 was just plist files. And just, you know, with a bunch of keys and values for each issue and everything like that. And the reason I wrote it this way was I didn't know core data yet. And with Instapaper, I do everything with raw SQLite, SQLite? I don't care how it's pronounced. Yeah. With raw SQLite calls to the C library with a few functions around them. So I didn't want to bring all that over to the magazine. I thought it was overkill. So I thought, you know, this is a really simple app. There's no real user side data, really. Like, it's just downloading issues and showing them to you. So it's so simple. I'll just use plist. It'll be fast, and I'll be able to get this launched quickly and find out if there's going to be any subscribers at all. Okay. So it was, by almost every definition, it was quick and dirty.
Yeah.
And what I realized by version 1.1 was that the system was just horrible. And because what I thought when I first started doing it, oh, there's no user side data that I really need to store here. It can be really, really gross and just a big plist file for each issue and a big index of the issues somewhere and a different plist file, and it'll be fine. And it turns out that that's not the case at all. That even though I thought it was going to be simple, there's all these complex things. Well, okay, is it downloaded? Is it saved? Is it deleted? Was it downloaded at one time and then they deleted it? Is it open? Is it collapsed? Are the issues here read? Is this, you know, and then when the server updates this article, is it easy to re-download just that article? So when I fix a typo in an article after it's been published, the app will download it without downloading the entire issue again. Like, there's all these things that I thought it was going to be a simple problem, but it really isn't simple. And so the solution I made with the assumption it was going to be really simple ended up ballooning into a tremendous pile of terrible hacks to get this stupid plist system working.
Yeah.
So eventually, you know, after, I don't know, 2 months maybe, I realized this was completely unmaintainable, threw the entire thing out and rewrote the whole thing in core data learning as I went, and it was fine. And I felt like such a fool for not having known core data earlier, because while it isn't the solution to every problem, it was the solution to this problem, and I just didn't know it. And it was definitely the solution to this problem, and so I definitely regret that. And that was just a huge technical architectural mistake to try to build my own crazy system that ended up being a massive pile of hacks because I underestimated the complexity.
Yeah, and the difficulty I always have with that kind of thing is, as you're describing it, is often I will do the same thing to start with. That almost always, whenever I'm building an app initially, its data store is some variation on plists or NSUser defaults. Like, that's where you start off. It's super easy. You can just get up and running and go. And I think the danger is, at what point do you it's having the awareness to say, at what point does that just completely break down? At what point is it no longer kind of prototyping? And at what point is this like, will this really stand up down the road? Because it's valuable to start where you started. It helped. I'm sure it helped you get off your feet and be like, okay, this is going to work. I'm going to build it. Here it is. I can play with it, you know, much more quickly than if you had said at the beginning, in order for me to do the magazine, I need to learn core data. That may have been much more intimidating and something that you would have been more resistant to diving into.
Exactly. Yeah. And it would have, you know, when I was starting it, this is one of the reasons I keep using PHP for all my server stuff. When I started it, I was just like, all right, I have to get this out quickly. I don't know if it's going to have any subscribers, so I don't want to spend 6 months making the app before I know if it's going to flop on its second week. I want to know that sooner rather than later, so I don't pour all this time into it that I could have spent on Instapaper. So I wanted to just get it out there as quickly as possible. And so the last thing I wanted to do at that point was learn a whole new technology. It's like, all right, and so the server side is written in PHP using the exact same framework as Instapaper and Tumblr.
Yeah,
because that's the framework I know best, in the language I know best for the server, and running it is really easy and really low maintenance, because once you've designed a framework to run 150 servers, like at Tumblr when I left, when you bring it down to 11 servers at Instapaper, it's really easy to run.
Sure.
And when you bring it down to one server, like the magazine, it's even easier. And so I used what I knew. And that works great in a lot of cases until you run into something where something you don't know yet is a way better solution, but you don't know about it. And that's, you know, that's why you got to always keep broadening your horizons so that you know what tool to use for the job. Because if you don't even know about a whole class of tools that could save you a lot of time on what you're doing, then it's harder for you to make good decisions about what to use.
Yeah, and that, I think that speaks to all kinds of areas. It's about how you keep trying new things, learning new stuff, having projects whose purpose is just to learn something new, to kind of just keep trying to stretch out of your comfort zone so you can try and just see what's out there. I mean, it's always kind of amazing when you find some of the things that you know, you're very rarely solving the problem for the first time. Someone else has almost certainly already solved it and solved it in a way that's more that's cleverer than you could ever come up with.
Exactly.
So,
that being said, I still don't know what the hell storyboards are.
I don't know why
I would want to use them.
I think that's okay. I think that's,
I did just start using Arc finally.
welcome to you know, to 2012. That's
I'm shipping a point update to the magazine that changes it over to Arc, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. But like for marketing reasons, it makes sense to call it a point.
Sure.
So it's going to be like 1.2.1 or something like that. Changing over to Arc and rewriting the whole back end.
It's pretty.
Yeah.
It's though that's again. It's what I love about the technology like that is that let me focus on more interesting problems. And I think that's even maybe the undercurrent of what you're getting at with this challenge was you had to, in order for you to keep advancing the app and making it better and better, you had to keep hacking on top of hacks in a way that, you know, was probably a distraction from what you're actually trying to accomplish. Your goal wasn't to try and work out a way to store this data. Your goal was to enable a user-facing feature that would make the experience better when reading. And so that's always the thing that's so better. Like, I love about Arc is I don't have to worry about memory management nearly as much as I used to. And obviously you have to have an understanding of the fundamentals and et cetera, but in general, it's one less thing that I have to worry about. I have less code to write, and I can just focus on stuff that users will actually care about. Because no one, if you put in your release notes, you know, migrated from retain release to Arc, nobody's going to care. Who? I mean, maybe your techie followers or someone would be interested about it, but it's like otherwise, no one cares.
Although, you know what? The reason why I switched to Arc is pretty embarrassing.
Massive memory leaks?
No. Because I don't do that much crazy stuff with how I manage my objects and my code. So for me, the regular retain release and conventions around that, auto release stuff, that's always worked pretty well. I very rarely had memory leaks in my shipping code. It was fairly easy for me to do the old model. The only reason I switched to Arc, the driving force here, because again, I didn't want to learn anything new up front. I just wanted to push through and release this thing. The reason I switched to Arc for this version is because I added, for the first time, AF networking to my project.
Mm.
And the current version of AF networking requires Arc. And I thought, you know, I could just enable it for this file, but that's kind of hacky, and I don't really trust that to not... I know this is probably superstition on my part. I know in reality it's probably very well isolated, but I didn't want to just have Arc enabled for part of my code.
Sure.
I thought that's going to cause problems later on, or that's going to at least cause annoyances. So I thought, you know what? Let me just convert the whole thing. So that's why I'm using Arc, because I added AF networking for some conveniences. Now, I'm not even using most of what it can do. I added it for some conveniences, and I realized, you know what? Let me just switch the whole thing over now. That's how I started learning Arc and using Arc.
Yeah, and imagine it lets you. Yeah, it's like once you do it, you move on, and now you can focus on whatever it was, adding AF networking, adding more, you know, rich media support or whatever it is. It's
really boring. It's working around newsstand bugs. That's the reason I'm adding the AF networking. It's because working around the newsstand asset download, the NK asset download class, which is limited.
Limited. That's the politically correct or gentle way of saying it. It's limited.
Somebody said recently, I forget who on Twitter, you can definitely tell which APIs Apple designed for its own use and which ones they designed for others to use. Newsstand is very clearly not used by Apple. It is very, very apparent that they don't have any of their own apps using Newsstand. And it kind of makes sense. Like, why would they? Like, it doesn't... You can understand why they wouldn't have Newsstand apps, but yeah, it's very clear that they don't use Newsstand.
Yeah, and you that's just part of being on the platform, I suppose. That's just the kind of thing you just learn, and you're just like, all right, well, I'll work my way around. And
the advantage is I'm very unlikely to ever be Sherlocked here.
That's true. That's right. You're not in a path that's likely for them to get into. So
exactly.
All right. So I think that's probably a good point to wrap it up. Before we do, though, I just wanted to give you, if people wanted to follow your work, follow your apps, where would be the best place for them to find you online?
Go to marco.org or Marco Arment on Twitter. Or if you want to be mostly ignored for a long time, Marco on app.net.
Excellent. So anyway, thank you so much for taking the time. I think it was I definitely learned a few things, which is always great. And I hope everyone else did too. Thanks.
Oh, I have a Tentis account.
Oh, a Tentis account.
That's a real way to be ignored, because I at least have an app.net client that I can occasionally remember to launch. I don't even remember how to log into Tentis. So if you find me there somehow, that's the best way for me to never find that information.
That's kind of like leaving a treasure buried somewhere that one day you may discover.
Exactly.